This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 335, I think. At least that's what it says on the top of my little piece of paper. I'm going to turn some air conditioning on here, such as the air conditioning bee in my little car. I had a bit of happy news this past week. I had to get my car licensed. And so I'm always wondering, is my car actually going to pass inspection when I take it in? But it passed inspection, yay. When the guy was filling out the inspection form, and he was filling out the information on the car, he kind of looked at me. He said, "Now, this is a Chevy Prism." I said, "Right, Chevy Prism, because, you know, it's actually a Toyota Corolla." I said, "Yep, Chevy Prism." I said, "This is, you know, that little twin of Toyota Corolla they made." And I said, "It's got 167,000 miles on it, and I'm wanting to take it to 250,000 miles." And he said, "You know," he said, "you probably will." So that's what I'm hoping for. I realized today, or this last week, when I got the renewal form for it, I realized I bought this car in 2005. I bought this car a decade ago now. Man, it's been a good little old car. I mean, I've had very few things that I've had to fix on this car, and it just putters along. I'm in the process of losing the starter switch, or the starter, one of the two, or some connection between the starter switch and the starter. But you know what? Sooner or later, it's going to fail and strand me someplace. But we're just going to get that fixed, and we're going to keep driving this little car. Because I love this little car, and it gets me around, and it gets 30 miles to the gallon. And man, I love this, because it gets me 35 miles to the gallon. I just do basic bait and maintenance on it. I get a 56 or 57 cents to the mile deduction on this car, and I get 30 miles to the gallon. So if you figure over 30 miles, I'm getting, what, 3 times 18, I'm getting about $16 worth of a deduction, a business deduction. I'm getting about $16 deduction for every mile I drive this car, and gas is only costing me $2.50, and I get a $16 deduction. That means that I'm, even after I pay myself back, if I've got my figures correctly, it's like a $14 deduction for every mile I'm driving. And I drive, you know, hey, it can't be that much, because I drive about 2,000 miles a year. No, yeah. For every 30 miles, right. So, you know, so that's about 60. I drive about 2,000 miles a year. I get a 50 cent deduction, let's say. So that's $1,000 deduction there. But out of that $1,000, I'm only paying a pittance of that in gas. Plus, I have a little oil. I really think this car is making me money. Because it's so cheap to drive, and I don't have to repair it much. I do have to pay insurance, but the insurance is cheap on it because it's been in an accident, so I don't have any kind of collision insurance or anything like that on it. Or comprehensive, I should say. I have collision. Don't have any comprehensive insurance on it. So it's cheap. It's good. It's good. I love this little car. Anyways. Everything seemed to go fine this week at work. This was a big day today. Had a big meeting with project leaders today. We were coming to the end of one of the stages, and so I did a presentation for them, and we talked, and then did a presentation with the subject matter experts after that, and they all nodded and said, yep, we think we're on track. We think we're ready to move to the next stage, so we'll get started with the next stage and get moving on that, and then we'll start putting all these pieces together and see if we can actually come up with an application that is useful. It looks good at this point, so we'll just keep puttering along one step at a time, so that's good.
I think last week I mentioned that I was going into the epilogue for Windfall the Straight Gate,
which used to be Windfall the Narrow Door, but I think it's getting changed to Windfall the Straight Gate. I was hoping to get the epilogue done over the weekend. That didn't happen.
Oh,
I started the epilogue on Friday, wrote most of the day on Friday after I got back from doing grocery shopping with my parents. And I thought I made a good start on the epilogue, and, you know, but it was just too much backstory, because this particular epilogue deals with a character that you never see in the rest of the book and will never see again. And so you got to kind of get up to speed and bootstrap up the character and, you know, make them somebody you want to read about. And so I started with a certain type of scene, the character getting slapped. Slapped is what it was, you know, to invoke empathy and that kind of thing. But then I had to have why they're getting slapped and the backstory on that. By the time you do that, you're several pages into it and you really haven't gotten anywhere. And it was, nope, this isn't going to work. So then I backed up, took another run at it Friday night, because my beloved was working on something and she was going to be working late at church. So I took another run at it and I thought, okay, that's better. But still wasn't. So then I got up Saturday morning before we went to a family breakfast, worked on it some more. Started it the third time, keeping pieces of what I had done before, but basically moving things around. Got back after the family breakfast, thought, nope, started it Saturday afternoon, finally, by that fourth time, starting it Saturday afternoon, I thought, oh, okay, I'm started, good, now we're getting somewhere. So then I got into the mid part of it, and then it was like, nope, so I restarted that. So by about Sunday, I had it restarted, and I thought maybe, well, the midsection, I thought, okay, maybe I'm there. And then I thought, nope, on Monday, restarted the midsection again. Let's go. I'm going to have to toot my horn. Go, hey, there we go, okay. It turned green. The light had turned green, and we were just sitting and sitting. She was looking at her phone or something. So then I think by about Tuesday, things had settled in. I still didn't quite have it. By Tuesday night, I went out with a buddy. We got something to eat. I was telling him, man, I'm in the crush of it now. This epilogue is just not cooperating. I can't get it to sit down. And, you know, I was like, ugh, you just gotta muscle through it and find out. Well, then by Wednesday, I think it was Wednesday going into work, I was thinking more about it. And I thought, oh, I could do that, and I could invoke that, and I could do this. And then it was like,
So, at this point,
I did some work last night on it. Sorry for the yawning. I did some work last night on it, and I started cranking then. I started making some good progress. And I thought, okay. And then tonight, I only have an hour set aside for writing because of everything else that needs to be done on Thursday nights, namely uploading podcast and blah, blah, blah. And so I'm only going to have an hour tonight, but I think I can get edited up what I wrote on Wednesday And then I think all that's really left is what I officially, well, I affectionately, should say, affectionately call the rah-rah speech. And I told that to one of my beta readers, and he said, "What's a rah-rah speech?" I said, "Well, it's the big emotional speech at the end of the books, you know, where someone is making a claim, and, you know, they're giving the big thing, and yeah, rah-rah." And so I still have the rah-rah speech to do. Or at least I say I'm getting close to the rah-rah speech. And I've got to account for all the... Okay, there he goes. I'm waiting for a guy to come on through the intersection. It looked like he couldn't quite get his... It's the day for that. Couldn't quite get his car in gear because he was just sitting there. So I'm hoping that I can get the rah-rah speech done tomorrow. If not tomorrow, then Saturday. That will still be okay because I will still then start the full read-through for the editing of the rough version on Sunday. I would love to start that on Saturday. But even if I start it Sunday, I've got 5 weeks to the release of the beta, and I usually only give myself 4 weeks to the release of beta. So even though the book is a little long, even if it takes me 3 weeks to do the rough editing, it's still just 1 week to lay it out, get the cover done, and then order the books so that they have them in. The goal is to have them in by October 1st. So that night, I can go ahead and package them all up, and then October 2nd, I can put everything in the mail, and then I'm done for 2 months, and then I start on the next book, which is Windfall, A Seed in Secret, I think. Pretty sure that's what that is. A Seed in Secret, which is a really interesting parable. I've talked about that before. So anyway, so life is good. Everything's puttering along. I'm a huge proponent of quest epic adventure. A huge proponent of creating a legacy. Do something that if you do not do it, there will be a gap in the world. And then do it. Even if no one reads it, you know, whatever. May have grandkids, great-grandkids, they may read it someday, has value, which is really the whole point for these podcasts, because, you know, who knows, someday my great-grandkids may be listening to this. And it might be like a time capsule thing. For nothing else, it's like a diary for me. I was telling a buddy this week that I really am expecting at some point for the automated transcription programs to be available, and I will just be able to point them to all of the 335, or by that point, whatever, the 500 or 750 podcasts I've done, and have it actually write out a transcript of everything I said. And then a buddy this week said, yeah, and once they do that, then they'll have analysis programs that they'll be able to, you know, figure out what your philosophies and your beliefs were and all that kind of stuff. Oh, that might be interesting. So we'll see. Anyways, so at this particular point in time in 2015, on whatever it is, the 28th? Is it the 28th of August or the 27th? It is the 27th of August. My watch is one day ahead. I've got to fix that. I was going to fix that this week and I didn't do it. We are at this point in a very interesting time. I've talked about this before, and I'm always fascinating to see how the futurists are predicting, because we are at this point where everyone universally acknowledges. We're not trying to act like it's not going to happen, but we are universally acknowledging at this point that a significant portion of jobs will be erased by technology. So we're at that point, and it's very interesting to watch as the thinkers of the world try to predict what is coming. Try to imagine. Me, even though I'm not fearful, I'm not exactly hopeful. You know, the two big positions are, it's either going to create a dystopia or it's going to create a utopia. And just from a practical standpoint, when I look at it, I think, yeah, I see dystopia coming. I don't see how it could end up being anything but dystopia, or at the very least, dystopian for what are normally the movers and shakers in the world. I'm watching a documentary, or I finished the documentary on Netflix, on Ayn Rand and her philosophy of objectivism. It's very, very interesting. But she made some predictions about where altruism would lead our country. And some could, you could say that they are coming true. I mean, it depends on your viewpoint, your interpretation of a few things. And so it's very interesting to see people, you know, making this claim that her predictions are all coming true and she saw it ahead of time and blah, blah, blah. Some of their connections were a bit tenuous as far as I'm concerned, but that's okay. That's okay. I think Ayn Rand has some interesting things to say. I don't necessarily agree with everything she has, but there's some interesting things to say. So the only way that I could see this not ending up as a dystopia for everybody if, in fact, Ayn Rand's fears come true and they just tax the living daylights out of all the movers and shakers and the big businesses and then just give it to people. Or they force businesses to employ humans, which is always a possibility, but I don't think it will end up very well. Anyway, so, having said all that, this guy, Jeff Colvin, has wrote a book called Humans Are Underrated. He is at, is it Fortune Magazine? Fortune Magazine. And he had a op-ed kind of a piece that he had done that was basically an advertisement for his book, because that's how things are done, which that's fine. And so he was putting forth some of the ideas that he has in his book. There's some interesting stuff here, but what fascinates me is the mechanisms, the hoops that people jump through to try to support their belief that, in fact, we're looking at a utopia. And though he never says that, the entire article is very upbeat, albeit he does admit that times are going to be hard for some people. He just doesn't make any prediction about how many of those some people there will be. And I think in the tone of his article, he's a bit optimistic on how many of those some people there will be. Anyways, we'll get to that. So he goes through, does a rehearsal of what is acknowledged at this point. He said, he starts out by talking about, if you thought emotions were beyond the competency of robots, you were right for a long time, but no more. Or maybe you believe that humans uniquely will always have to perform the highest stakes, most delicate or demanding tasks in our lives, such as surgery. But researchers at University of California at Berkeley are training a robot to identify and cut away cancerous tissue. Not like today's surgical robots, which are actually tools used by human surgeons, but entirely on its own. He said, and maybe you figure that, that future technology, for all its wonders, is really just nibbling away around the edges of human employment. There aren't that many surgeons, after all, he said. But in May, Mercedes-Benz Daimler began testing the first self-driving semi-truck on the roads of Nevada. And the thing about it is the number one job among American men, held by 2.9 million. My neighbor is out and I have to say hello. How are you, sir? Good, good. Held by 2.9 million of them is truck driver. So Daimler right now is testing a self-driving truck. The advantages of a self-driving truck, you're going to get better fuel economy because it will tune itself to drive at exactly the speeds that is the best fuel economy. You never have to take breaks. They're on the road 24 hours a day. They are on time. You know where they are at any given time. Blah, 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 blah. Okay? He also says, you know, not even women are safe. Technology will continue to devour clerical and office tasks. And the number one job among U.S. women, held for now by 3 million of them, is administrative assistant. All that's going to go away. Because, I mean, we're getting things like Cortana and those types of things. Obviously, Google Now is nibbling at this, or many things are nibbling at this. I'm getting my mail one moment. And that will continue, and it will get better and better and better and better. And there will come a day when it will feel extremely quaint that we actually hired women or men to sit in front of bosses and do things like make appointments and set up travel and coordinate and review minutes and do all those things, because we will have machines that will track all of our movements, listen in on all of our conversations, reach conclusions, and executives will just say, all right, so we're setting up a meeting on Tuesday at 9 o'clock, you know, and it will just go ding, 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 and it will set it up. All that's coming. So, he said the big idea of all of this is kind of the kind of theme that you're seeing in Hollywood as to what they're portraying now, is that the big idea is always the same, for good or ill. Machines will eventually become just like people, only better. And so a lot of the places where we have been wedging humans in the gap because our machinery could not do it, not because it was valuable work for humans to be doing or meaningful work for humans to be doing, but because machines could not do it, that is going to disappear. And it's going to disappear, you know, fairly rapidly. People are saying in the next 15, 20 years, sometime in there, 10 years, whatever. He says, we humans have good reason to be uneasy. Strange things are happening in the economy. Ever fewer men of prime working age, the group that historically has been the most thoroughly employed, are working. While several factors are feeding the trend, most economists believe that advancing technology is one of them. In factories and offices, on construction sites, behind counter, technologies keeps doing more jobs better than people. Okay, I'm already home, so I gotta rush through this. So anyways, blah, 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 blah. So is there ever work that computers don't do? Well, you know, I don't know. You know, they've got a robot that's been developed in Germany that can load and unload the dishwasher. So the pattern is clear. Extremely smart people note the overwhelming complexity of various tasks, including some like driving a car that people handle almost effortlessly, and conclude that computers will find them mastering terribly tough, yet over and over, it's just a matter of time. We can't get our heads around the notion of computer power processing doubling every 2 years. That's important because at that rate, in 40 years, Infotech power increases by a factor of a million. He says the computing visionary Bill Joy likes to point out that jet travel is faster than walking by a factor of 100, and that changed the world. Nothing in our experience prepares us to grasp a factor of a million. And he says, at the same time, increasingly sophisticated algorithms let computers handle complex tasks using less computing power. Year after year, we reliably commit the same blunder of underestimating what machines will do. So he says, okay, so now that he set that stage, you know, he said, what's coming? And he actually has more of an optimistic tone at this. He said, well, humans will remain in charge. Okay, I think that's a little optimistic, but that's okay. Let's go with it. Humans will remain in charge. He said, there's certain things that humans absolutely do that computers won't. He said, humans must work together to set collective goals. Only humans can satisfy deep interpersonal needs. I mean, one of the things he claims is that humans will always want human surgeons or human doctors. I'm not sure that's true. But anyways, you know, we always need storytellers. So there will always be humans that are making movies, writing books. Yay. Ba-doo. You know, not that anybody will read my stuff, but that's okay. So although computers are getting better at writing as well, he says, look, this isn't just a theory. He said changes in the nature of work are exactly of exactly this type are happening on a significant scale. He said, ask employees which skills they need most in the next 5 to 10 years, as the Oxford Economics Research Firm did, and the answers always come back that they do not include business acumen analysis, P&L management, left-brain thinking skills that computer handle well. Instead, top employers have priorities that include relationship building, teaming, co-creativity, brainstorming, cultural sensitivity, and the ability to manage diverse employees, right brain skills of social interaction. So basically what he's saying is that to survive in the world that's coming, you don't necessarily need more analytical skills because the computers are going to be doing that stuff. What you really need is empathy. He said, that's why Oracle Group Vice President Meg Bear says, quote, empathy is the critical 21st century skill. He's got another quote that the Institute, which is the Kinsey Global Institute, found that from 2001 to 2009, transaction jobs, bank teller, checkout clerk, decreased by 700,000, while production jobs decreased by 2.7 million. But the jobs of human interaction, doctors, teachers, for example, increased by 4.8 million. So that will become, quote, the fastest category of employment in advanced economies, interaction jobs, humans interacting with humans. So because of that, he goes on and tells a couple of interesting anecdotes about how that, for instance, Southwest, there is a culture at Southwest Airlines of people treating each other empathetically. So where you come into work, they ask her how your weekend was, they talk to you, and how that there was an IT man who came to be a manager there, and he said, I don't know what's wrong with this company. I'm walking down the hall, everybody's trying to talk to me, ask me how my day is going, that kind of stuff. And that's not what he wanted to do. He wanted to come in, do his job, go home. And he could do his job, but because he didn't, you know, he didn't fit with the culture, they came and told him, you know, sorry, you just don't fit here. Because in order for our company to prosper, we need an environment where people are empathetic towards each other, they care about each other, yet it's it. Now, the thing of it is, he freely acknowledges that this is not something that everyone is good at. But he says, and he says there's no point in denying that women are much better at this than men. He said, but that doesn't mean that men are doomed. He says, within genders are enormous differences in the interpersonal abilities that people bring to adulthood, even before any training they receive, which for most people is little or none. But everyone can get better. It will be hard for some people, and some simply won't want to do it. It's about what they know. It's just the way they are. Okay, so he's acknowledging that, in fact, learning to be empathetic is not the easiest thing in the world. And, in fact, I would say that learning to be empathetic is a process of learning to deny your flesh and live more in the spirit, to be less ego-driven and more collectively driven. And that is not simple for a whole lot of people. And he talks about most people's essential skills remained largely the same from the emergence of agriculture 12,000 years ago to the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. The transition to an industrial economy in the West and the accompanying shift in skill values took well over 100 years. The subsequent turn into a knowledge-based economy took most of the 20th century. Now, as technology gallops ahead with longer strides every year, the transition to the newly valuable skills of empathizing, collaborating, creating, leading, and building relationships is happening faster than corporations, government, educational systems, or most human psyches can keep up with. That's disorienting, and it gets more so as the fundamental nature of value shifts from what you know to what you're like. And then he goes on to say, after saying all that, he said, well, if this sounds worrying, it shouldn't, because it's wonderful news. Just think of what we're being asked to do, to become essentially human, to be the creatures we once were and were always meant to be. Odd as it may sound, that's a significant change from what we're used to. He said, for the last 10 generations in the developed world, and shorter but still substantial periods in the emerging economies, most people have succeeded by learning to do machine work better than the machines could do it. Now that era is ending, machines increasingly are doing that work better than we could. We face at least the opportunity to create new and better lives. Staking our futures to our profoundest human traits may feel strange. Fear not. When you change perspectives and look inward rather than outward, you'll find that what you need next has been there all along. It's been there forever. In the deepest possible sense, you've already got what it takes. Make of it what you will. Okay, here's the problem. As I see this philosophy, I don't disagree with it. I don't disagree with the fact that to prosper, you need to develop empathetic skills in the years as they come. I don't disagree with that at all. In fact, in large part, my success in what I do has been dictated by the fact that I can communicate, that I can move across cultural mindsets. My user groups tell me, you know, the one thing we like about you is when you explain something, we understand that. What is that? That's empathy. That's me thinking like they think. That's the other thing they like about me. You know, I go in and get down in the dirt and the grime of what they're working on to the place that I understand it and I can communicate as if I'm someone who's been doing that job for several years. And they look at me and stop and say, you actually understand this. And I say, I'm trying. I don't come in there and tell them, you're doing it all wrong. You should do it this way. I never do that. I come in and I understand what they're doing and I respect what they're doing. And I give breath and I give thoughts and I give effort to the fact that I understand they're doing what they're doing because they were solving problems. And I will never go in and diminish those solutions, especially the ones that are working. So I agree, empathy is a great thing. But I think this article is a little flippant with how difficult it is for people to develop empathy. Because empathy is a characteristic of spirit. It's not a characteristic of flesh. And there is an active push within us not to be empathetic. And in fact, one of the things that technology spawns and encourages is a disconnection from empathy. When you're sitting across the table speaking with someone, you're looking at them in the eye, you're seeing all their body language, you have a much higher chance of having an empathetic response than when you're just Skyping with them. and you just see a flat image because, you know, you can kind of lean out of the frame if you don't feel like being in there. Oh, just a second. I got to go get something. You can just leave. And every time we reduce the interaction of any of our senses or the engagement of our minds, we just diminish that empathic response. So it's not Skype, it's email. The emails get shorter. It's not email. It's posting on Facebook. It's not posting on Facebook, it's Twitter. And at every scale, at every step down the scale, our empathetic response is reduced and our narcissistic response is increased. So he's right. Skills of the 21st century are empathy. But I don't think he's anywhere close on how difficult it's going to be for a vast majority of people to actually develop empathetic skills. Because when people can be entertained all the time and they can pop on Amazon and push a button and get what they want and they can zip through commercials and when they can watch all the episodes of some series and just binge watch and just hour after hour when they can play games and blow things up and run around and never have to interact with another human being except through a very stilted interface of people that they're playing with. When you have that kind of thing going on, none of that actually creates empathy. It creates me, 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 which feeds the flesh. And the more flesh-driven you are, the less empathic you are, because empathy is a quality of spirit, not a quality of flesh. So this is going to be fascinating. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.